here at Delaware Stadium. It's Blue Hens football, Delaware 6-3 on the season, playing host to the Albany Great Danes.
Walker is loose inside the 30-yard line and down. Uh-oh, he fumbles the football.
Ready for the snap. The hold is good. The kick is up. Distance is good. Accuracy is there as well. And the game is tied at 3, and that'll do it for the first half. Last punt was not a good one. Oh, it's blocked! And into the end zone and out of the back of the end zone it goes!
It's a safety!
It is a gift to Corey Spruill, heading toward the end zone! He's in! Touchdown, Corey Spruill! Got plenty of time looking, and that one is up for grabs. It's intercepted! Blaine Woodson gets it off the tip! It was knocked down by Jalen Kindle, and Blaine Woodson picks it off. It's second and goal from the 1 yard line. It's a gift to Corey Spruill. He walks in, and that's touchdown number 2 for number 21. And the Blue Hens put this one away on senior day. 22-3, the final score.
Welcome to the Delaware Football Roundup here on WVUD. With Michael Baumel, I'm Teddy Gelman. We're here to break down the Blue Hens' win on Saturday, November 11th, against the Albany Great Danes, the final home game of the season for the Blue Hens on senior day. A slow first half and a slow start. After a Frank Rago field goal to end the first half, Delaware went into the locker room. Tie game, tied at 3, but in the second half they outscored the Great Danes 19-0, en route to the 22-3 victory. It improves the Blue Hens to 7-3 on the season, 5-2 in the CAA, and drops Albany to 3-7 overall, 1-6 in the conference, with one game to go for the Blue Hens next week on the road against Villanova. Mike, our first impressions of the game, we talked about a slow start for the Blue Hens offense, but top to bottom, a really exceptional defensive performance the entire game.
Yeah, this was just, especially in the first half, it was a very boring game. I'm not going to sugarcoat it at all. And that's what we've seen from Delaware the past couple of years. It's been boring games, but now they're winning these boring games. First half, 3-3, and it was just, what's going to happen? Who's going to... I thought at halftime it was going to be one more field goal is going to win this game. But it was the Delaware special teams for the second week in a row that gave the team the spark between Nick Pritchard's amazing punts in the first half where... they downed it at the 1 yard line and then at the 3 yard line. It was both Buck Jones both times catching it. It looked like a pass from Nick Pritchard. And then Christian Lowen with the blocked punt for the safety. I mean, this is a guy that's only on special teams and making his name heard. Just came right up the middle, unblocked almost, and just got a hand up on it. And that's the spark that this team needs. It's interesting that once this team gets a spark, they seem unstoppable.
And when you talk about those two punts by Pritchard, Ray Jones for both of them, in the first half, he downed it at the 1 yard line. In the second half, Jones downed it at the 2 yard line. They seem to be in sync on those plays. And then we talk about the block punt, Christian Lowen, and that went out the back of the end zone for the safety. At that point, it gave the Hens an 8-3 lead. And then Corey Spruill got going, the freshman running back. We did find out that Kenai Kane was injured. Raku said postgame it was his shoulder, and he didn't comment any further information there. But offensively in this game, it was all over the ground. 254 yards for the Blue Hens on the ground, 86 of them for the freshman Corey Spruill. Joe Walker, 85 on the ground. Kenai Kane, 34 before he got hurt. Albany on the ground themselves, they tallied just 31 yards. So you see this the disparity there, excuse me. And passing, the Blue Hens did not have to do much. Only 51 yards in the air yesterday.
And that's what we're going to expect from this team. This team's going to be a heavy run team, and they're going to get their yards on the run. It's going to be very important for this team going forward for next week, and if they were to make the playoffs, that with their style of running and lack of passing, I guess you could say, is they need to be ahead of the sticks. They can't be falling in those long second and third downs, because then they won't be able to convert them. You're putting too much pressure on J.P. Caruso, who's not... he's very similar, I want to say, to Joe Walker in the scrambling type. We thought he was more of a pocket passer, but doesn't have the arm strength Joe Walker does. So you don't want to put him in those positions where he needs to be able to throw a long ball on a big third down. But going back to Corey Spruill, he said after the game that he did not know Kenai Kane was injured the first series he was in, And then the second series, he, of course, learned it. They just told him in the first series, go in. During the game, during the latter part of the second half, Kenai Kane was on the sideline in a sling with, I believe it was the right shoulder.
Here's Corey Sproul after the game talking to the media.
I mean, coach always tells me to be ready to go every game. You know, I practice with the ones every week. So it's really about just being ready when the number's called. Kenai went down, so, you know, I just wanted to make sure, like, I filled in his shoes the right way and just step up and not be a freshman, just make plays.
He had two touchdowns, two rushing touchdowns. The first one, of course, that was his first ever college touchdown, and then he came back later on in the fourth quarter for the touchdown that pretty much put it away, if it wasn't already away. That brought it from 15-3 to then 22-3. And I was saying on the broadcast yesterday, Mike, that the way this guy runs, he's not the biggest guy, but very much of a downhill runner. It seemed like whenever he got hit, he would roll forward for a couple yards. And I was reading something last night and a comparison people were throwing out of an NFL runner, just for the people who may not be as familiar with Corey Sproul, kind of a Tim Hightower type of a back, somebody who runs, keeps their center of gravity low to the ground, and always seems to be moving forward. And he had a career day yesterday.
And another thing about him is once you get him going, he's very hard to stop. After he started, the first couple plays on his first couple drives wasn't doing too well. Then once he got a big run, got some momentum going, it looked like he couldn't be stopped on those two drives, getting those two touchdowns. And I'm really glad that they kept going with him that whole drive to give him the reward of the touchdown, because he worked so hard, not only this game, but throughout practice, and just to be able to get that first touchdown for him in his career probably just gives him a little bit more momentum going forward, especially since we don't know what's going to be happening with Kenai Kane.
Danny Rocco had some good things to say about the freshman postgame.
I say this to our staff all the time. As I watch our practice film each week, Corey catches my eye every single day. I mean, there's a reason we played him in August. And I told him 4 weeks ago, I said, we're going to need you in November. And, you know, as it is, we certainly needed him today.
Rocco went on to say after that, that moving forward, depending on the injury to Kenai Kane, they're going to continue to use Kareem Williams. He didn't play much yesterday. And then he offered Thomas Jefferson's name at the end of it, who came onto the field at the very end, almost as if it felt like, here you go, this is the end of it, you're a senior. Well, you could have had another year, but chose not to return. And on senior day, we'll give you some carries for the final drive here on our final regular season home game of the year. But they've got options in the backfield now. Certainly, we hope Kenai Kane is okay moving forward with what he's done with the team. But seeing the depth now provided with Sproul, you have to think that a good rushing attack has the potential to get even better here in the stretch.
And what's nice about what we saw about Sproul, if Kenai Kane is available for next week and going forward, is they are two very different runners. We don't really have a downfield runner. We haven't really had one since, I would say, Wes Hills. He's very similar, and that's what we've been missing, I think. We have the powerful guy, but we don't have the guy, once you cut around the edge and make the turn around that corner, that can just sprint and run downhill. And that's what Corey Sproul provides to you, a smaller guy, but still with a lot of power.
We talk about the rushing game and what the Hens were able to do yesterday. The Walker dynamic, something that they did last week up in Maine. But Jamie Jarman, the wide receiver, he was back yesterday. Although it didn't seem to fool Albany at all, they would run this kind of sweeping play, and a lot of times it would be Kenai Kane just to keep it himself, or Walker would run, and he had a little bit of success. He didn't end up running for 85 yards on 11 carries, but there wasn't really any type of explosive plays. I'd say the only explosive play on the ground for Walker was the one early on when he fumbled it. It was into the red zone, and they looked like they were driving. I thought he actually might have broke it for a touchdown if he didn't get caught, if they didn't catch him there. What'd you see from that dynamic, Walker kind of as that dual threat quarterback, and the implementation of both that alongside Jamie Jarman?
I think that one thing that needs to be better put together is what's going to happen on those plays, because it was always the same play. It seemed like it was always Joe Walker in the shotgun or the pistol, and then Jarman was on the left side of the offense and would move in motion to the right side, and Joe Walker would either pitch it to him or he would keep it up the middle. And Albany figured that out, that that was the same play over and over again. So they put one guy at the edge and one guy right up the middle. So they had both prevented. I would like to see maybe like a play action of that play. Have Jarman go in motion. Joe Walker can throw the ball. We know he can throw the ball. If you throw some trickery in the offense, he can get it to the open guy. And with that, you can get to the open guy. And also, with Joe Walker's yards yesterday, he became the fifth quarterback in Delaware history to accumulate both 2,000 yards passing and 1,000 yards on the ground, which is a tremendous accomplishment.
And for all the criticism that he may receive, that's something to remember. What he's been able to do in the air and on the ground, and you have to think him and Jarman and whoever else they decide to use in the backfield could be, it could provide some electricity in terms of what you could have in terms of a big play moving forward. So offensively, mainly in the rushing game, Corey Spruill got it done, and J.P. Caruso didn't have to do a lot in the air. I thought he had a really nice throw to Vinny Papale on that one play. It was a 23-yarder, and it was almost half of the 51 yards that Caruso accumulated in the game. But he was 7 for 11, didn't pass very much, but he didn't make any mistakes. And I know once or twice he might have been under pressure, he threw it away, and I thought he played smart football yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't throw the ball in place that he shouldn't have. We've seen that previously where J.P. Caruso will throw off his back foot, do a Joe Walker, throw off his back foot, and will get intercepted. Very smart football was played by this Delaware offense, I think, for the majority of the game. You can say that they only scored 3 points in the first half. But that's going to happen with this offense. And you're going to have the defense, which what they did yesterday is exactly what you need them to do. Keep them in the game until the offense can get something going. Because eventually in the game, the offense will get something going. Yes, for the past 2 weeks, it hasn't started right out of the gun for the offense. But eventually, it's just one big play that they need. Whether it's a big play on special teams, a big interception or fumble from the defense. Once this offense gets going, they are a good offense, but it's just getting that offense going.
And on the other side, the Blue Hens defense allowed only 120 total yards yesterday.
Today, our defense was really extraordinary. We had one drive in the game where they had 4 or 5 first downs. I'm sorry, I don't remember, but it was the only real drive that they were able to put together. We held them to a field goal.
And that, he's right, because that was in the first quarter when Albany had over 10 minutes of possession time in the first quarter. It was a real fast-moving quarter because they kept on running the ball, a short completion. There was no real reason for the clock to be stopping. And they moved it down the field, got the field goal. From then on, they had extremely limited success. And that was it. Beyond that point, the Blue Hens defense tightened up a little bit more. And what I was saying on the broadcast is that I thought the defensive performance becomes a little bit more magnified when you have a lack of an offensive performance. Luckily for the Delaware team, the offense got going a little bit later on. But I guess what could you say about the way that defense continued to consistently make stops time in and time out?
I mean, one thing I read about this defense is they held it to 6 first downs and 120 yards. We haven't seen that in Delaware football since 2011 when they held Del State to 4 first downs and 112 yards. I mean, to be able to hold a Division I offense to 120 yards is mind-boggling because they are Division I athletes as well. Yes, our defense is probably one of the best in the country, but this still is a Albany team that, yes, their offense isn't that good, but they still are Division I athletes. And that's just crazy to think about. And also, it's been Delaware the past couple weeks recently that has been winning the field position battle. And when you win the field position battle, it'll help you in the long run. Delaware's average field possession starting at their own 44-yard line. Albany's at their own 25-yard line. And you have to think, yes, the defense just kept holding them, and then Delaware would get the ball in good field position. But you also have to think the special teams put the defense in a good position to stop them and then put the offense in a better position to be able to move the ball and score.
Well, it was the second drive of the game when they marched down the field and ended up making the field goal. And from there, as I said before, they didn't really do anything. It was a Blue Hens offense that was able to have a little bit of success. Then Joe Walker fumbled the football. They end up getting the field goal going into half, a very fast-moving half. I think it was just over an hour of actual time. It wasn't even 4:45. Game started just after 3:30 when we went into the locker room for halftime. Rocco said that that was a critical moment for him to kind of keep his poise, keep his confidence going into the 3-3 game at halftime.
Right, wrong, or indifferent, I played the game to my strengths today, which was our defense, which kind of made me comfortable there at the end of the half. When we got the ball back, I really felt if we can get points on that drive, we will win this game and go into the locker room 3-3 with ball. And, you know, could have played it differently, but chose to play it that way and did go into the locker room with kind of the weight of the world off of our back. And our team really responded again in the second half, which is something we've done quite a bit here this year.
And the response wasn't immediate. They didn't come out in the second half and all of a sudden scored these 19 points. It was a slow buildup. The Blue Hens' first drive of the second half was a 3-and-out. The second drive, they got one first down and then punted the football again. But then on that third drive, they moved it down the field. Frank Rago ended up hitting the field goal. And then after that is when we saw the blocked punt for the safety. And that's when they really started to take hold.
Yeah, and it's just, I said it earlier, this team, once they get going, they're a good team, and if not a great team, but it's getting to them to that point to get going. And towards the end of the first half and beginning of the second half, they started getting some things going, and it was slow to get it going this game. We saw last week in the main game, it was much quicker. Once, I think it was the second drive or third drive, the offense was clicking. Defense was already clicking. It was a very fast progression. But this week it was a slower progression. But there are a lot of aspects of the game that were overlooked. I think one of the biggest impacts of this game was Gene Coleman. Gene Coleman had 3 kickoff returns for a total of 82 yards, averaged 27 yards, a long of 36. When's the last time that we've had 3 kickoff returns in a game that went more than 10 yards? I mean, this is a team that doesn't like to bring the ball out of the end zone on kickoffs and would rather take a kneel, but Gene Coleman provided that spark. He provided electric because when he broke a couple tackles on that 36-yard return, everybody on that sideline was ecstatic about it.
Yeah, I thought Gene Coleman did a nice job in the return game. And then you talk about in the kicking game, I feel like we talk about it every week, how good both, one, Frank Rago was with the field goals he needed to make. He made them. And the punting of Nick Pritchard, it just smooth, calm, and collected, sending it down. And those 2 times, as we mentioned before, where Ray Jones downed it at the 1-yard line and then at the 2-yard line later on, just very solid special teams, and that's something that the team struggled with a little bit early on. And I don't want to call it the turning point, but I think that safety, when it became 8-3, was a point in which they really took control, and the Blue Hens defense remained spectacular. Offense got the ball back, and I think that is when, either just before or after that, is when Kenai Kane got hurt, because then we started to get a heavy dose of Corey Spruill, and he ended up running for the touchdown, 15-3. Then you get interceptions from Anthony Jackson and Blaine Woodson, his first of his career, and the defense just continued to swallow up Will Brunson, quarterback for the Great Danes, and his offense. Then later on, Spruill scored the final touchdown, 22-3, and the second half was completely dominant, and the score probably ended up being a representation of how good they actually were in that game.
And also something that we can't overlook is Jake Roth. Jake Roth, 60% of his kickoffs go for touchbacks. And when we just said it, that Delaware doesn't like to bring the ball out of the end zone when they're returning kickoffs, but when you don't allow the other team to return a kickoff, it's huge because then you know exactly where they're starting. They can't have a big run. And you were saying about that safety that really sparked this team. I mean, think about it. Christian Lowen, a guy that really doesn't play other than special teams, just blocks a punt for a safety. That whole sideline was electric. He was ecstatic about it. I mean, of course he would be. And then you have the contributions you said from the interceptions. But there was also a play that I think was a crucial turning point on defense where they handed the ball, Albany handed the ball off, and the running back was going right in the direction of Buck Jones because Buck Jones is playing up on that play. And he saw him cut back, and right there was Bilal Nichols for a loss. And it's just the defense on our team has so much chemistry. These are two guys that played high school ball together, and they know exactly where each other are going to be. So the chemistry on this defense is just so helpful in those situations. And that big tackle from whenever Bilal Nichols makes a tackle in the backfield, everybody's excited. It's just like when Troy Reader makes any tackle on the field.
Well, last week, I remember Colby Reader and Troy Reader combined for 24 total tackles, which is really an outstanding number. This week, the leading tackler for the Blue Hens defense with 9 was Jalen Kindle, and then Blaine Woodson had 7, and Nichols and Troy Reader had 5, and those were the leaders tackling-wise, but you look at what Albany did, they didn't put together enough plays to give you the opportunity to maybe get 17 individual tackles like Troy Reader did last week en route to becoming the CAA Defensive Player of the Week. And that's, again, a credit to the defense for stopping the passes. Brunson, 12 for 25, 83 yards, and 3 interceptions. He did not have a good game at all. And Carl Mofer, their leading rusher on the ground, 18 carries, but only 47 yards. That's just over 2.5 per carry. It's outstanding numbers across the board for the defense, and top to bottom, you can look secondary, you can look in the linebacking corps, and you can look on the defensive line. They were all great. Rocco spoke about that post-game as well.
Our defense is talent-laden with guys at every spot, and I'm not necessarily saying that every player is all conference caliber, but at every position, in the D-line, we've got an all-conference caliber player or two. At linebacker, we got an all-conference caliber player or two. In the secondary, we got an all-conference caliber player or two. So as the game wears on, they're just given more opportunities to make plays.
And they took advantage of those opportunities across the board. We always mention Blaine Woodson, Bilal Nichols, the Readers. We mentioned Adderley. You wanted to touch on Nigel Hill, the freshman. I'm sure you'll get to it, but again, I thought he had a very, very strong game.
He has not had one bad game since he started playing against Virginia Tech. And this is a player that he knows everybody's going to try to attack him because of his inexperience, because of his size. But they underestimate him so much, and then he comes up with all these big plays. Yes, he may not be flashy on the stat line, but in coverage, he is sound. He barely loses his coverage ever, and he's always with his guy, always can stay speedy with his guy. He'll have a breakup or two, but he's not going to have the biggest, flashiest numbers, but he's a huge player, and it was the next man up mentality for him, and he's really proven that.
Well, Albany entered the game with one of the worst defenses in the conference, and that's just a bad formula when you're going up against the Hens defense, who is not up there as the second or third best defense, statistically speaking, as they were in September. They're down to number 5 entering the game in total defense. Most certainly, they're now up to 3 or 4. I haven't checked on that stat. But again, it just speaks to the bad matchup for Albany. And Albany's defense has been pretty good. But Delaware took its time, and Corey Spool became that guy to punch it into the end zone twice. So now we start to look at where we are here with the conclusion of this one. 7-3 is the Hens' record. Other scores from around the CAA yesterday, James Madison won, Elon lost to New Hampshire, and that's a game that had implications for the playoffs as well. So now James Madison is still in first, they're 10-0, they haven't lost a game since September of 2016, Elon 8-2 overall, 6-1 in the CAA, Stony Brook, same records, 8-2 and 6-1, the Hens are right behind him, 7-3, 5-2, and New Hampshire, 7-3, 5-2. So those are the 5 teams that we're looking at here. Delaware will play Villanova next week. Elon will play James Madison. So looking at that, you'd think Elon could very well fall to 8-3. And then New Hampshire is going to go north to take on Albany, and that will be a tough defensive game as well. What's your take on the landscape of the CAA as it relates to the FCS playoff picture?
For people that are saying the CAA is not the best conference in FCS football, I disagree. I mean, you have potentially five, if not more, schools that are now fighting for a playoff spot. And the real question is, is the selection committee going to take five CAA teams out of the 24 teams that make the playoffs? And it's hard to see that happening just because, yes, the CAA is one or two of the best divisions in FCS. But then you're going to let out other teams that may deserve it, and you don't want to show favoritism, I guess, for the one division that may be the best. And it's just hard because Delaware is in a hard situation right now, because if Elon were to have beat New Hampshire last week, we would have been sitting a lot more prettier, just had to beat Nova and then not had to worry about it. But now that New Hampshire beat Elon, it's a little trickier on what's going to happen going next week and when the selection Sunday, next Sunday.
So Villanova is typically a very tough team. They were ranked in the top 25 to enter this year. They've kind of fallen apart this season. They're now 2-5 in the CAA, and they're 4-6 overall. Of course, they're not going to make the playoffs. They will be playing for Pride this coming Saturday at home against Delaware. What do they call that? The Battle of the Blue? So it's the annual battle between the two teams, obviously a historic rivalry. Have you had a chance to scout Villanova a little bit? What's your take on the generalities of that team?
I mean, recently Villanova just has been looking awful. I mean, their past couple weeks, they have not been able to do anything. I would say 3 weeks ago when they played Elon has been their best week since, like, up to this point from that time. They lost that game 19-14 at home, which isn't bad considering Elon, the surprising team in the CAA, how well they were doing. But then you look the following week, they lose at home to Richmond 22-0, and then yesterday they lost to Rhode Island 20-6, and Rhode Island not a good team and more towards the bottom of the pack. And now Villanova towards the bottom of the pack, only 4-6, but this is a team that has had Delaware's number the past couple of years. When you usually have a school's number, it doesn't matter what your record is that year. It doesn't matter, especially in a rivalry game that you play every year. They want this game maybe more than Delaware wants it, because they want to spoil Delaware's playoff shots.
Well, offensive lineman Brody Kern said after the game yesterday, he said it was hard not to think about the Villanova game entering the Albany game, because we know how significant that game will be. Obviously, the significance would have been less if they did not beat the Great Danes on Saturday. But he said, you know what? In 4 years, none of the guys on this team have beaten Albany, and we're ready to go. So you said you feel like Albany, or Villanova rather, is going to be ready to play. I see it going both ways. I find it hard to believe that Rocco will not get his team ready to go. Because you talk about the iffy nature of who's going to get in the CAA playoffs, but if you're 8-3, you've got yourself a really good shot. It's not a guarantee at all, but it's a record that typically gets you in. And then when you look around the CAA, obviously the Hens will be scoreboard watching. I'll tell you what I think here, and I want to hear your thoughts on this. If New Hampshire loses to Albany, obviously the Hens are above them, because New Hampshire would be at 7-4. And if Elon loses to JMU, which will be the expected result, although JMU's offense has not quite looked as dominant as it was last year. They were in a very close game against Richmond in the fourth quarter yesterday, but JMU ended up outlasting them. So if Elon loses to JMU, Elon will fall to 8-3. And if you match up an 8-3 Elon team and an 8-3 Delaware team, to me, Delaware is above that, because Elon does not have a single signature win. They'll also have a two-game losing streak. And finally, Elon has just barely gotten by a lot of these kind of average middle-of-the-road teams. I could see the other side of the argument there, but if you were to pair those up together, that's where I'll go with that. But also, Elon was ranked, and that probably does have an impact in the voters' minds.
I will say one of the biggest wins for Elon this year was when their third game of the year, when they played at the time number 16, Charleston Southern. Elon wasn't ranked at the time. Charleston Southern has then fallen out of the ranks. They're receiving votes. But the fact that they beat Charleston Southern. Then the next week, they beat, at the time, number 6 Richmond, still Elon, unranked. Then the following week, they played Albany and beat, at the time, number 19 Albany. So Elon beat 3 ranked teams in a row until they were finally ranked. And especially because of the surprise of this team, the Cinderella story, I guess you could call it, because no one expected them to be this good. Let's be honest. Everybody expected Elon to be middle, bottom of the pack of the CAA. And this is a team that was just ranked 7th in the playoff rankings.
I will say, I certainly think they'd be deserving over... Now, New Hampshire had a good win against, I'll have to check specifically, one of the FBS teams earlier this year. I'm checking their schedule now. But New Hampshire played an FBS team, not a good one. I want to say Georgia Southern. That is who it was. Second week of the year, New Hampshire beat Georgia Southern, who is now 0-9. They lost to Auburn by like 60 points. That's an FBS team. New Hampshire, besides that, has played very close games as well. So it's kind of a toss-up between it. I point to the Stony Brook and Richmond wins for Delaware, but I also acknowledge the Towson loss and how bad that looks now when you pair this up. Elon, you would if Elon beats JMU, they're not only in, they're also going to get a bye in the first round. But you could see maybe two CAA teams who haven't played each other in the regular season, maybe get paired up in the first round of the playoffs. They have done that in recent years. I was reading that this morning. So maybe we could see a Delaware versus Elon. But again, it's dependent on what happens with New Hampshire. And are they going to even let 5 teams in to begin with?
And I think to also decide if they're only going to take these 4 teams from the CAA instead of 5, they may do, well, let's do common opponents. And for Delaware, their 2 CAA losses is JMU, which everybody this year has lost to, and Delaware's loss doesn't look that bad. 2010 loss kept their offense in check and got something going. But the Towson loss, yes, Elon beat them in double overtime, but guess what? A win is a win. And that Towson loss still glooming. Yes, you can't go back on the past, but if Delaware were not to make the playoffs and they win next week, I think the Towson loss has a huge role in it.
No doubt. It's a good point. No doubt at all. And that's why scoreboard watch, because if New Hampshire loses to Albany and the Hens take care of business, I think they're in.
Yes.
Would you agree with that?
100%.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. And we saw in the first half yesterday, or on Saturday, the Albany game against Delaware was not a walk in the park. Obviously, the Blue Hens were the more dominant team, but Albany at home in the final game of the season, I anticipate that'll be a close game against New Hampshire. Then it'll depend on what happens in the rest of the country and which of the other bubble teams end up losing. So there's really a lot at stake, but all the Blue Hens can do on Saturday up at Villanova is go out there and get the win against a Villanova team that is not the typical Wildcat team. And you have to think they're going to be ready to play, although we do recognize the rivalry and that Villanova definitely want to spoil the Hens' chances.
Yeah, I mean, because the only thing Villanova really is playing for is to spoil the Blue Hens' chances, and they would not love nothing else but that because of the rivalry and because they've had their number in the past couple years. Both teams are going to be wanting this game more than any game they've wanted this whole year.
Well, we'll have coverage for you just before 1 o'clock on Saturday, November 18th. Delaware traveling north to take on Villanova. It is the final regular season game of the season. The Blue Hens, 7-3, looking to improve to 8-3 and give it a shot toward the playoffs.